in this
mic.
So Mike and I would like to speak to you I'm going to say something else, but I'll be a good Buddhist. rather than a talk this evening or an inquiry, I thought instead for the our time together that it could be in the form of question and answers. But just before that, just a couple of other small things preceding it. Over the days, and this morning included, quite a few of you very kindly left a note or stopped me on the pathways with some request for the one-to-one. And as it often happens on the last full day, there have been rather a lot of one-to-ones there, which I very much appreciated, I think. And sorry, apologies. but there are just a few who wished to see and just didn't have the time, and the voice was just beginning to dry up a little bit. So just last half hour or so had a little bit of a break. So still like to see you. So anyone today, who, or last day or two, left me a note or ask me on the pathway, I'll endeavour to see you first thing early after breakfast tomorrow morning out there. If there's not too many of you. All right. Also, sometimes in coming to a closure, there are people here and there are good friends here and partners here and people who are close to each other. And sometimes the bonding that takes place, the hug and the friendships that takes place there, I just think is precious and lovely. That love and kindness and friendship and connection is very much part of these teachings, and sometimes quite spontaneously that occurs on the last afternoon and the final mornings. And I have to say, with regard to that, that over the years, these turn out to be not only retreats, and as some of you know rather well, they also become partner forming agencies. And there are a few people who have become friends, of course, and very deep bondings and friendships and have taken place. And partners have formed, and out of the partnership, children have formed, and love is everywhere. Right. Why not? We have the Yatra in France every year. Yatra is a pilgrimage, usually 90, 100 of us. They're out camping there, and long silent walks and talks. And a few people from Israel have come quite regularly to the yatras, to these walks, pilgrimages for 10 days in France, and again relationships all form there. And time to time, I have heard in nearby tents in the middle of the night, I thought people are doing their pranayama breathing exercises. Perhaps they were, but life goes on, doesn't it? What to do? All right, before we go into the mundane, we'll have a question period. So sometimes, out of the days, that we've been here together, areas and questions and areas of concern may arise. And of course, coming from the meditations, your sitting, walking, standing, reclining experiences, the informal times as well, taking quiet time or the meal or the sleep times, sometimes from aspects of your day-to-day life or things that you've heard from us as teachers, talks, inquiries, instructions, meta-meditations, and much else in the sharing and in the exploration of the Dharma. And all of this dialogue and exploration, sometimes some aspects and points in it touch us, it feels relevant. And of course, sometimes of what we hear about these things or Dharma or issues in life. And I do feel it's rather important that we find ways in these explorations to address the many institutions that touch upon us in our day-to-day life, some of the values which touch upon us, and all of that is part of the discourse and is certainly part of any Dharma narrative. Everything is to be included, and you probably have felt that when you've been speaking with Sandhya and with Iran and myself, that what you bring and what you wish to speak about, that's what we explore and share with you. And those one-to-one dialogues with you have touched upon many, many areas and many, many issues. And that's part of the inquiry, that's an ongoing inquiry, along with the support of the silence, with the support of the meditations. So, if in the asking of the question, because I have the privilege of the microphone here, so please ask the question and then I'll endeavour to reflect it back so that everybody from the back to the front has heard the question, if that's okay with you. So anyone who has anything that you would like to ask, please feel free to do so, and we'll just flow through over the period. Yes, sir.
Okay.
If you'd like to give your first name when you speak, it'd be nice for everyone.
Yes, my name is Ellis.
Ellis, yes.
And my question is, how do you act or when you're in a situation where everybody's around, I mean, you want to give, you want to practice the dana, for
yes.
example,
mm-hmm.
and people around you are not willing. Something that comes to my mind is the bus station in Israel. It's like a zoo. And it's like feeding a very hungry monster.
Mm-hmm.
Who you want to give and it eats. I'm not sure if I'm clear.
Yes. What would be the giving at the bus stop? I'm just not quite clear.
I guess nothing. Maybe the privilege to sit, maybe.
Oh, I see. Yes, they give it. Yes, right. I think it's a genuinely important area, because the act of giving does show a spaciousness, a generosity of the heart, and of course, in a larger realm and dimension, life is given to us. And we enter into this world, it's given to us, there we participate in it, and there's something about some harmony and accord when we understand the deeper significance of the giving. And of course that giving can be the giving up of the seat, letting go. It's a giving. There is the giving of time, the giving of love. One of the important areas of giving in life is giving real quality of attention to another human being, to really be present for somebody, whether particularly if somebody is in some kind of need or difficulty. There's the giving of the material world, there's the giving of money, there's the giving of support, there's the giving of time. And all of these expressions of giving, if we understand the beauty of it, but it is important that giving needs renewal. If a person gives and doesn't have any renewal coming in, then there will be exhaustion, there will be tiredness, and there will be disillusionment. And so sometimes we have to remember, in the giving, it also has to include our own being there. And so you have come here and you've been giving yourself some time to be with yourself, giving yourself some time to be in the nature, to be in the supportive sangha. And that's an important giving. And our hope and wish, of course, is that out of that giving, it will benefit other people. Yes, any question, please? Yes, please. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's the easiest thing to do. It's harder for me to open to receive.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know what's your approach, because when I give, I'm a control freak. And so when I give, to open to receive is the unknown for me. This is where I let go of control, and it's harder for me.
Yeah.
Okay. The separation that you make, the division that you make, is difficult for me.
Take a little bit about the giving, a little bit about the receiving. I remember years ago, I used to go when I was in Calcutta in India. Used to go to see Mother Teresa, and Mother Teresa, much Nobel Prize winner, much loved, regarded as a saint in the Catholic Church. And well known for her giving, and she inspired a whole network of nuns and missionaries of charity, making giving the act of love and an expression of the deepest wishes, shall we say, of Jesus. And I remember asking her about giving, and then she said, very Catholic, she said, it's a strong one-liner. She said, beginning starts when it hurts. Giving starts when it hurts, when it's difficult. That's when the giving starts, when it's difficult. I don't necessarily agree with the view, but it's that sometimes I was running a men's facilitation group. Facilitating a men's group. This is years ago, about 15 or 20 of us. And I said I was inspired by a women's group, I'll explain. And I said to the men in the group that next week I want us all to bring something to the group which is hard to let go of. Something which you value, which you hard to let go of, and we'll put it all on the table, and any one of us can go and pick something, whichever item, to let go of something which we really don't want to let go of. And I was inspired because a women's group in the town had a meeting, and they agreed to give one valuable piece of their jewellery back to the earth. So they went out to Dartmoor, to the moors, a very remote part in West Country, had a small ceremony, and took off a piece of jewellery, a bracelet, or earrings, or a ring, or something, and did a ritual, and gave it all back to the earth, as a practice of giving back. And people said, oh, why didn't you sell it and give it to charity? And no. They wanted to give it, came from the earth, and give it back to the earth. So when the act of giving came, I knew immediately in myself that I had to give out a book which I had had, a Buddhist book, for about 30 years, and I thought, oh no, no, I won't give that. I'll give something else which will be easier. And the conscience wouldn't let me. So the following week, I, you know, came in, and the group came in, and some of the guys brought all sorts of really beautiful things. Whoa, whoa, whoa! There, which they gave, and we just put it all on the table. And then one guy, we sat around the table, and one guy would take one item and another item, and it was a beautiful act of sharing and giving and letting go. Just say, in both cases, sometimes we do get tested a little bit when the letting go, the giving or the giving up or the sharing is not easy, and it's not easy because holding. But life, it will give us up. So let's start practicing. There. The other, of course, as the good lady just said there, some it is easier to give. It is easier to give. But the difficulty is to receive, and our hearts must be big enough to be able to receive as to be able to give. Because if we can't receive, we are blocking a person's opportunity to give. We don't have that right. That's not our privilege.
Can you want to drink something hot?
No, that's very good. No, that's very fit. It will keep me flowing along. That's very kind offer. So sometimes the act of the, we have to ask ourselves, and it's part of knowing ourselves, am I able to receive? And am I able to receive? And sometimes people say, oh, can I do this for you? I really would like to give this to you. And as much as possible, no matter what it is, to be able to receive. Sometimes, I know for myself, I receive, and it may be something actually I don't need, but I receive, and then I have the opportunity to give elsewhere. And this movement of giving and receiving, is an important area, and we need to look. Am I able to give? Am I able to receive? And that gives everybody opportunity. Yes, any... Another question. Yes, please, yes.
Just to expand on that, you know, in the Jewish culture,
yes,
like the Jewish mother, for example, you know, that's a good symbol. Sometimes giving, or that might not be something you call giving.
Yes.
That's still an act of controlling other people.
It can be, and it references...
Then you wouldn't call it giving.
No. Well, it's a conditionality. And... and particularly that can enter into roles of authority, and of course the parents, and as a parent myself, that very easily, that of course there is giving, and the giving of love, the giving of attention, the giving of material needs, etc. But very easily the self, the I and my, enters into that, and there is some expectation or demand or control that because I have given you so much, therefore you should do as I tell you. And that's a very conditional giving there, because it's a giving, but as we say, strings attached. And I remember, I think it was only last year, I was asking, because I often hear, is it the Polish mother?
Right.
Yeah, the Polish mother syndrome. Yeah. And it's not something familiar in the English world. So I asked, you know, for some explanation or definition of the Polish mother syndrome. And people left me all sorts of notes. And the one that has stayed with me over the year is the Polish mother is one who rings up her children every single day and says to them, I've sacrificed my whole life for you. And I get it, I get the point.
Why do you miss them?
Right. I mean, I don't know if you are. Right. And so, in areas where the act of giving, it is also, the spirit of it is the act of letting go. And what sometimes we find with that there is a happiness in the gesture, great or small. There's a happiness in the flow, a happiness in the expression. To give is a lovely, lovely feeling. It's a privilege, really, to be able to give to each other. And we need to keep that. And of course, something may or may not come in return. But we just keep that movement. And there are many, many, many ways that can express and manifest itself. Yes, please. Just one person here. Yeah,
could you say a little bit about the observer and what we should do about the observer in practice?
Yes. So the question is about the observer and what we should do about the observer in practice. Very important question. Very important area of inquiry. In everyday life, there is a kind of simple duality that is going on, and the duality can be rightly described as the observer of the observed. I could say I look at, the witness to what is witnessed, the experiencer of experiencer, the knower of what is known, and the arising of the self takes the formation, a little technical language, but it takes the formation of the observer, or the seer, or the knower, or the listener, or the meditator, and the meditated on. And our life seems to move a great deal in this duality there. And we're interested in the duality. The duality meaning, one side of it is the meditator, the observer, the experiencer.
Shniyut.
And the other side of the duality, the twosome. The other side of it is the observer and the observed, the witness of the witnessed, the seer of the seen, the meditator and the meditated upon. So the sense of I arises, this we keep to the observer language, as you ask, with the observer. Sometimes it's just very clear and very, very simple. I could say, right now, I am the speaker. And the words coming out is the spoken. So there is the speaker, and here is the spoken. Just simple conventions of things. Part of our practice is what happens in relationship to the speaker, the observer, same event really, what happens there? And sometimes much else impacts upon the speaker. If the self ego gets in one direction, it could be, I am the speaker, you're just the listeners, disciples. You'll be up here one day. This is a speaker, ego, I'm here, whatever. There's a few egos on stages, we know that. And, or the ego of the speaker, or of the experiencer, or of the observer, different expressions of the same thing, ego can just be as big going the other direction. So sometimes the ego is building myself up, whatever it might be. But the ego, the self, the I, the my, can go in the other direction. Who am I to speak? I'm useless. I say some most stupid things. I really piss people off. I shouldn't be doing this job. Somebody else should be doing it. I'm not good enough. I'm hopeless. Who am I to talk? Etc. And we want to acknowledge in the conventions the experiencer with the experience, the observer with the observed, but to see what habits, tendencies and patterns come along with that. Sometimes what comes along with that, the experiencer, the observer, the creator of something or whatever, sometimes it's comparing. Ah, I'm much better than they are. I do it much better than them. They're just whatever. Really, who am I? They're much better than me. And so ego is putting ourselves up, putting ourselves down, comparing ourselves, and we want to see what is it to be very steady without all that extra stuff around the observer, around the there, and just to look into that simple duality of the observer with the observed, just to look into that formation there, to get to know that formation. Why? It's our life. Why? This is it. Why all the events of our life are bound up with the observer and the interpretation of events, inwardly and outwardly. This is our life. And in the exploration of that, much can be uncovered. And so some find it useful just to have a simple basis. What is the observer's relationship to the observed? What is the relationship to the sense of the observer? Like I just described. At our exploration.
And how do you call the third thing?
Another
thing.
What would be what?
The thing that observes the observer and the.
It's it would be a hall of never-ending mirrors. So in other words, we just try to keep it very, very simple. There is the observer, and sometimes the observer or the witness looks at the objects. There's been a lot of observation over the days of your breath, of your body sensations, of your states of mind, of the thoughts that are arising, of the tendencies and the love and sensitivity and respect and connectedness and disconnectedness and silence, all have been entering. So, one's been noticing that, one's been seeing that very, very clearly. And sometimes, as I said, we've noticed also the response to it, what actually takes place with that. If we say to start the thinking and we don't notice it as thinking, then the thinking could arise, who is observing the observer? But then, who is observing the observing of the observer? Mirrors and mirrors and mirrors and mirrors there. The thought does that. And the thought hasn't been noticed that it's doing that. So sometimes the thinking starts to make the observer complicated. So our practice is just to see that. And sometimes the observer and the observed, the experiencer and the experienced, sometimes those two sometimes kind of drop away. There's just observing. There's just seeing. There's just noticing.
So is it the third thing?
No, there's no third here. It's about just sometimes the process of things, it doesn't feel like it's an observer. It doesn't feel like I am watching what is happening. It's just kind of happening. And it's not to say one is more true or less true than the other, but it also reminds us not to take up a specific position. That's all. Not to cling. Not to make a hierarchy out of it. Yes, please.
I don't know if this is related, but when I'm sitting doing Vipassana, sometimes, often I feel vibrations, like I'm sensing different parts of my body.
Yes. Mm.
But then I have a feeling that I'm sensing it on some level, some internal level, but on like a kind of gross level, something stuck. So I test it by slightly moving, and I feel, oh wow, there was great tension in my neck, even though I was feeling vibration there. So I'm at this point of really questioning the stillness versus the movement, and really how to practice in a way that's like good, that's healing also for my body.
Sure.
It's a little confusing.
Yeah. The question is about the relationship to the body, and also about some of the tensions that are experienced in the body, and what it is to have a clear relationship with the body. And it's an important area, simply because we're trying to have a very clear relationship with this event called the body. And in that, sometimes with the stillness, as you point out, arises. The stillness, the value of it, even for short periods, allows some old tensions and pressures to arise. They may land anywhere with the body, or, and in the stillness itself, there may will be, after some period of time, pretty well for sure, some aches and pains arising. Not because of any tension, but the body is in the same position and some pain arises. With the latter, body in the same position and pain just naturally arising, part of our practice is to explore that pain. We've been given instructions over the days, as I said, to open out the consciousness, open out the pain horizons there, and it will make a contribution to putting the pharmaceutical business out of business. And sometimes with the tensions that arise, we have to use our experience here. It may mean stillness and exploring, and it may require movement. The movement may be just the movement in the posture, but the movement may need more. It might require dance. It might require movement exercises as you're receiving during the days. It may require massage. It may require some expressive kind of movement. And we need to keep in the relationship to the body all of that very open and clear with us, so that the yogas of every day with movement genuinely do matter. And finally, to say to another point, the idea that the body is mine is an idea. It's an idea. And we move back and forwards in different kinds of relationship. So sometimes the body is mine, and when it's viewed in that way, it's a possession. My body, like my recorder, my shawl, becomes a possession, and then that's the relationship that arises. But sometimes as well, it shifts from that to a complete identification of the I with the body in everyday language. And in the complete identification with the body, then it's I am sitting here. In actuality, the eye can't sit. It doesn't know what there. The mind can't sit even. Only a body can sit. But we get used to the language of I and my. And then sometimes it changes again. And sometimes there is body sitting here. There is no I and my in the perception. Just body is just sitting, nature is just sitting, elements are just sitting, vibrations are just taking place, sensations are just occurring, tensions are just arising, and there's a very bare consciousness which is seeing the bodily life without I and my. And that's again part of our practice. Part of our practice. The more clear that seeing is, without rejecting the body, experiencing the body, the more clear, the more content and happy and relaxed our relationship with the body. And the more I and my around the body, the more fear, the more anxiety, and the more being judgmental. Fear, anxiety, and being judgmental about the body, about the way I look, the way I am, or whatever, the things we were touching upon previously, is due to the degree of I and my. To the degree I think I am the body. To the degree I think the body is me, my possession. We're trying to free ourselves from this view, while being very loving towards the body, very respectful, taking great care with posture, with diet, with exercise, there, and deeply knowing the body does not belong to me, it belongs to nature, and being very, very clear about it, because it's the fact.
So yes, sir. Who am I?
And wrong question, sir. Wrong question.
Why?
Because it's the unanswerable. Because the in the relationship too, I know it's a deep and important question. I know that the question arises for many. Just who am I? There, and it's a very deep, deep human question. But there is a point, I would say, if you might, you know, here, there is a point when this question has to go. And what I mean by that is, coming back to the good question over there of the observer and the observed, what I can say as a human being from experience, that which is observed is not who I am. That, if you can follow, that which is observed is not who I am. I can observe the body. I can observe it from as it were, above. I can observe it, like you were saying, from within. I can observe the body. So the body is an object of attention. I can describe it. I can talk about it. Say its age, its size, its weight, its colour, blah, blah, blah. So the body is an object which I have an interest in and I make reference to. That which is an object of attention cannot be me. Any more than this is an object of attention, I could describe this. But equally, you many times over the days you have come, you've spoken to us, and you said, these thoughts are arising. And the thoughts come and go. I say, all these thoughts are going on in me. These stories are going on, and these ideas are going on. The reason you and I can speak about it is because we can see it. What we can see is not who we are. So, body is not who I am. Feelings not who I am. Can see the feelings. States of mind, not who I am. And thoughts are not who I am. And at this point, some, not in this Dharma, but some, will come to the conclusion, that means who I am is consciousness. The one who is conscious of all of that, this is my true nature. Really? Really? Where does this view arise from? Where does the view arise from? You say, I am not this body, feelings, thoughts, state. I am not this, but I am this, called pure conscious, radiant conscious, infinite consciousness.
What is that, the
observer? consciousness there, and therefore the observer, as it were, is enmeshed in this large consciousness, and this is who I am.
Okay.
It is a view born out of the mind. It's a claim, and in making understand claim,
the claim,
a claim to claim something.
Hmm?
Ba'alut.
Ba'alut.
It's ownership.
Yeah, yeah.
Ownership. Ba'alut.
This is who I am. But the difficulty with the claim is that from the standpoint of our experience, if that is who I am, why do I keep falling back into the pattern, I am thinking, I am sitting here, I am happy, I am unhappy? So you can take the view, I am consciousness, I am pure, wonderful, radiant, liberated, awakened, blah blah, consciousness. But from the standpoint of the experience, I may have some experiences of a great, amazing, immeasurable, infinite consciousness. It can happen in meditation. It can happen spontaneously. It can happen in the nature. You say, wow, wow. But that I, which was I am consciousness, then slips back into the mundane. I am thinking too much. I am bored. I am sitting here fidgeting. The I doesn't seem to stay anywhere too long.
So who am I?
I just told you. You are not who you think you are.
Okay.
The I is a odd phenomena. A very odd phenomena, and the difficulty just with the question of who am I, it kind of looks for an answer. So the question who am I tends to invite the wish for I am. I say this I am would be a claim, because it can't sustain itself. I say I am pure consciousness, it's fine to say it, but it won't last. The I will fall out of the pure consciousness and it will fall straight back into I am thinking. I am wondering. I am believing. I am. It will go. That's what the I does. And if we understand it very well, there will be a liberation from the I and dependency on it.
So a good question.
Good to a point. Yes, sir.
Yes, I want to ask about you talk one of the days about the hope.
Hope.
Yes. Or the problem of hope.
The problem of hope.
Yeah, and the chance that you'll get disappointed. Now there are many, you know, new age approaches.
Are there?
Question
is on hope, and there are some.
Yeah.
The good man is, I'm telling the people at the back, that there are some new age approaches, and we're curious.
That working on the mind in order to get some required results.
Yes.
Like silver method, or like movies about like Bliff, or like secret things like that. And
Yes. There are movies, Blip.
Yeah.
And what was the other one? Matrix? No.
No, it's just
The secret.
Yeah, but
they all seem to come from one country, don't they? That should be a health warning to start. Carry on.
There is one fact about the placebo effect.
The placebo?
Yeah.
Mm. Go on.
You believe in it?
Carry on, sir. Go on. I'm interested.
It's tested.
Tested?
Yes.
Yes.
Placebo works.
Yes. Yeah, I know. No,
yeah.
I'm familiar with it.
Something and, for instance, or you can say, I know, but these movies are more in materialistic way, but I know that with the people which are have cancer, we work with them in methods of hoping and believing that they will be better, and many times it helps them in improving their health.
Yeah.
And you say that it's better to think that there is good hope that it will be in a good way, but there's also a chance that it won't. So if you tell this to a person, it might fall him to the wrong side.
Mm-hmm.
Unless giving him the hope that this will give him some power in his mind, in his body, that even his beyond his mental capability.
Did you ask me personally? It's not what I would say to it. Sorry, thank you. Not what I would say at all to a person. That having met with and talked with over the years, people in very critical conditions, people who have come on retreats, people who have said to me, Christopher, I am dying, I haven't got long left, and this will definitely be my last retreat with you or any other teacher. And it's the real task and responsibility in the communications with the person to help the person make that incredible journey through life, through sickness, through pain and through death, and to give the love and the resources which will make that journey much easier there. I'm well aware of the some of those schools of thought and ideas, and if in a genuine way that the support which is given is very helpful and it really does work for certain people, then all credit to it and make use of those resources. But I still would say with regard to that, that there can be and there are statements of real self-deception taking place which cause certain people who are dying terrible pain and anguish, because the belief is arising that I can make myself well through hope and through belief. And I feel this view is a very dangerous view. It's not supportive of the facts, and it can lead people into a terrible state of it's all my fault that I am not getting better. And there are those voices around. I've listened to those voices, and I do say that the language and the discourse that we enter into people who are going through major crises is vitally important. Vitally important. And therefore we really have to listen, what can the person accommodate, what can they work with, what works for the person, and in never ever to engage in anything which could lead to a great deal of self-deception. Clear?
What do you say about placebo?
Pardon?
What can you say about placebo?
What can I say about placebo?
I mean,
I
tested scientifically in court.
Pardon? So what I can say about placebo from friends who have been engaged in this using medication which is a placebo and medication which isn't, that as all things there is no absolute criteria. And what I mean by that is that there are some people who take the placebo there. And one of the what's that popular medication for depression?
Prozac.
There, and believing that they took Prozac, and it was a placebo, and as you pointed out, began to feel that some of their symptoms were getting less and began to feel better. There are some people like that. And there are some people who took the placebo, it made absolutely no difference to their condition, and they felt just as unhappy and depressed as previously.
It's not 100%, but there is still some improvement.
For some, there is some improvement, and for some, there isn't any improvement whatsoever. And one's got to be rather clear.
Improve your chances.
Pardon?
But it is so it improves your chances.
So to be rather clear with regard to this, any generalization tends to be out of touch with the needs of certain people. That we must remember. Yes, please. So she just repeat this slowly. A Buddhist book, and she's hoping to remember that what she read, she can put into English for us.
Even after the greatest storm,
So again, and I've been speaking to a number of people over the days together, and we live in a culture and society where there's such a wide variety of mental dis-ease, where there's mental faculties and difficulties. It's showing in some of our children in adulthood, and we wonder what on earth is going on, that there is so much of this there. And in all of these circumstances and situations, I think there is some other kind of listening and learning that we have to find through these there. And certainly for some, in the deterioration of the mental faculties, Alzheimer's disease as one. Where I've seen that from time to time, not very often, but from time to time with coming and entering to the life of men and women of practice, then sometimes in the monasteries and sometimes elsewhere, all the practice hopefully will give, if this happens for any of us, and it has to be the possibility, that whatever that arises with our mind, whatever the condition, hopefully, using the word again, hopefully there will be some peace with the situation. But I do say one of the great resources for clarity and for keeping the inner life vital and vibrant and alert, which is possible, is these kind of practices where we give so much care and attention to mindfulness. It brings energy and vitality to the cells, it keeps that alertness, and it's truly wonderful to see men and women who, of any age, in the senior years, are very alive and vibrant and alert. And I think we can learn from that kind of attitude there. Having said that, of course, there are people who, living like that, had a very full and vibrant and alert life, and however, unfortunately and very sadly, there are genetic factors and hereditary factors which impact upon the cellular life, and the outcome is we call Alzheimer's there. And again, with that, these are some of the unknowns that you and I live with in terms of what might be there. Yes, please, yes.
I'm trying to solve this contradiction I have.
He's trying to solve a contradiction which he has. Yes.
Okay, when you say that when we meditate,
yes.
You specifically, that when thoughts come,
yes,
we shouldn't fight them.
Mm-hmm.
We should say, okay, you're welcome.
Yes.
And on the other hand, when they come, we need to get back to our breathing.
Yes.
And I see it as a kind of fighting them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's saying, okay, I'm not with them, I'm with the breathing. And so it feels like those both.
Mm-hmm. The question is that sometimes it does feel like fighting, which I can appreciate, if the primary intention is to be with the breathing, and then the thoughts are arising, then it feels like, oh, I'm fighting to stay with my breath, or I'm fighting to keep out the thoughts, and there's a struggle with it. The element and the practice of calmness in our meditations is especially important with regard to this, that it doesn't have to be struggle between the breath and the other. And the more you develop calmness, both in the daily life and in the meditation practices, you will notice, sometimes quite dramatically or sometimes quite gradually, a definite kind of shift and change in the inner life. And the shift and change could be a relaxed way of being in which it really doesn't require much effort to be with the breath, and can be quite steady with the breathing as the primary object, to use the language we use. And thoughts can come and pass, and there is a natural returning of the attention to the breath. There's no sense or feeling in the inner life that one is resisting the thinking, or struggling, or fighting, or trying to push it out of consciousness, or push it aside. It's when that happens, and of course it happens easily enough, but it's usually a sign of the need for more practice. Mm-hmm. So.
Christopher.
All right, I'll take a couple more questions on the back. Thank you. They see, I missed the word.
They see as someone, they support them.
Yeah.
And recently I noticed that my communication with myself looks like they are talking to me, I'm supporting them, and I have like all three minds and to ask them how I'm doing.
All right. Hello, the feeling.
I think something
I said, I know the feeling. Yeah, right. So, fine and well, so far. It is an important area, and to put it in a slightly different kind of language, certain roles in life is a strong representation to the world, to others, and that role is an archetype which embodies all sorts of ideals and pictures and images, and it isn't easy to see beyond, to see through the role. I mean, to give a very, very good example, and some of you will be familiar with it. Gwenwyn, my daughter's mother, she lives just 10 minutes up the road. and she became good friends with the wife of the local doctor, and so they have children of the same age, and so regularly the doctor and his wife would drop into the house, drop the kids off and pick the kids up. And she said every time he came in, she'd think, God, one of us is sick. You know, she couldn't relate to him as just the father of the children. She could only talk to him as a doctor. You know, she related to him as a doctor. The archetype is so strong, that's all she could see, like that. Teachers and psychologists are in the same boat, you know, there. So sometimes, even though I find this for myself, and perhaps you do, sometimes we're completely out of the role. There's no archetype, there's no presentation, the retreat's over, thank God it's over. And one's out of it, and one goes off to have a coffee or whatever. And then, like where I live, in Totnes, and there, the coffee shop is downstairs and upstairs. And I've had to take refuge upstairs, because I'm there having my coffee and, you know, reading my book or a laptop or a newspaper or something, and then, ah, Christopher, just the one I want to see. You know. And Christopher, I just want to talk about my practice. Have you got a few minutes? Oh, please, give me a break. I'm out of the job at the moment. Yeah. So sometimes with that, as the person nicely and sweetly followed up, actually it's nice to be asked sometimes, how are you, how's your day, how's your practice? We're doing our practice as well, and the difference is that we just talk a bit more.
A bit more.
A bit more, too much more maybe. All right, one more question then we'll finish with. Yes, please. I'll try. The Buddhists will send me to hell, but I'll try. And back to the observer and the observed, in the perceptions of things. A turning point. Sometimes in life we have these turning points. Sometimes it's in a short conversation. You know, and something is said to us, and whoa, like that. And there have been a few over my life, and hopefully a few over your life. Sometimes it's just like the receptivity is there, something is said, and something opens up. Wow. And in this case, I was on the road, young guy, about 25 years of age, and did the hitchhike across what's called the Hippies Trail. I was actually on my way here, there, and I left home in April of 1967, and I thought, well, I'll hitch through Europe, then through Turkey and Syria and Lebanon and into Israel, stay in a kibbutz. I could have ended up here, but then you never know your luck, do you? But then we all know what happened in June 1967. Mm-hmm. So I thought, no, I'll stay with the Muslims. And forgive me. And instead made the journey across through Turkey, and then through Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan and India, and took that way across. And I have to say, the hospitality of the Arab culture is absolutely wonderful and precious. It still has a very deep spot in me. And just recently, I was in India a few weeks ago, and we had a young Dutch guy from Amsterdam, and he had a bike with him. And I said to him, where did you get your bike? He said, oh, I got it in Amsterdam. So I said, how did you get here? He said, I cycled. It cycled from Amsterdam to Bodh Gaya. Oh, well, exactly, exactly the same sound came out of my mouth. Whoa. There. And so he cycled through Europe, guy about mid-twenties, cycled through Europe, then through Turkey, and then he cycled down through the very bottom of Iran. And from Iran, he then crossed into Pakistan, so to miss Afghanistan, then cycled across Pakistan, and then into India, and then he was in with us in Bodh Gaya. And I miss that. Catch it. So, and I said to him, "Look, you're Dutch. You know, I mean, the worst, of course, the Americans, the British, and the Israelis in the Arab world, you know, etc." But the Dutch have got troops in Arab countries as well. And I said, "So what was the hospitality like?" He said, "I never paid for anything the entire journey through the Arab countries. They wouldn't let me pay for a meal. I never stayed in a single hotel or guest house. The entire way I got supported." And I said, were you the only guy, cyclist, there? And he said, "There are a few of us, not many. But at one point in southern Iran, there were six of us. And we kind of cycled along together, and we went off in our different ways." And it was very, you know, touching for me, because it just shows the spirit of the culture, and lovely hospitality here, of course, and the spirit of the culture is still there and very, very... strong and beautiful. And it kind of breaks lots of stereotype pictures that we have about different places and countries. And it's a lovely thing that the entire journey, which was over some months, that the entire journey, the people seem to know this guy is Dutch, but he's not his government. He's not confusing the military and the government with the person. And if that, it would have been dangerous for him. And then he was cycling on. What was the question? Completely lost in my story here. The robes, yes. Yeah. So yeah, right. Thank you. So when the teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, living in the forest for many years, and I asked him a question, you know, about life, who am I, that kind of question. And he said, "If you really want to know, he said, there is no point in being grasping or attached or clinging to anything, because that will block the realizations there." And then he had his robe on, and he pulled the robe off, and he said, "This is not worth being attached to. The idea, I am a monk. This is also just another view. It's not worth being attached to. I am a monk. This is not who you are." Wow. And at that point, in one of those turning points, wow. And then I stayed in the forest for 2 or 3 weeks there, and then I came down to see him, and then he dismissed me, etc., sent me away, even though I wanted to be a monk. So, because the motivation is such an important aspect in the tradition, the motivation, I went away, went up to Laos, crossed the Mekong River. There was a war going on in Laos. The Americans were engaged in the secret bombing of Laos. And so up there in the monasteries and staying up there, it was horrible up there. And then crossed the Mekong, hitchhiked back down, and then he saw the motivation was strong. And the important aspect of all of this, there was no concern about me being a Buddhist monk. It just wasn't the issue. The issue was that I was in an environment like you and I are in here, which was supportive for practice. And that was the spirit and the letter in which I was there. And so when I express regularly various doubts, you know, like, did the Buddha exist? And all right, rebirth and the, oh, and the religious stuff and etc. All outer stuff, don't bother with it. Get on with your practice. And that spirit of that really I found incredibly supportive, extremely free-spirited, very, very free-spirited attitude. And sometimes the missionaries would come. Oh, the Christian missionaries. Oh, so I was the only Westerner in the monastery, so it looked like I was a good candidate for conversion. And so they would come, and always various conversations with them, because in the monastery the language of God is just not used, and you know, most of the monks never even heard the word. So the missionaries would come, and you know, they'd learn to speak fluent Thai, and then the teacher would send them over to me. Oh, go and talk with Kitty Supo, that was my name, go and talk with him. Oh, no. There. And so one of them said, we have a direct telephone line to God. Wonderful. Very nice. And he said, but to reach God, you've got to go through the telephone operator. He said, and there is only one telephone operator, and his name is Jesus. And you have to go through the telephone operator to get to God. There is no other way to get to God. And I said, I'm a Buddhist monk. We don't use telephones. He had no sense of humour. What to do? All right, enough for today. Let's have a quiet minute together. Beings live with happiness. May all beings have a free spirited way of life. May all beings be mindful of the telephone. Oh dear. All right, enough. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Much appreciation.